One thing that I do is I'm sort of recruiting people all the time. I don't wait until I have a job opening before I start sort of thinking about who I need to fill that job. I think there's this delicate balancing act of like making sure you give people enough information that's useful to them, but not too much that they won't want to come back tomorrow for more. I look for elements that are repeatable, but also habit forming. So what are things that, like, whether you have three sections or five, what are things that people are going to naturally want to come back for every day? What makes them come back and open that email?
Hey, Brad, welcome to the podcast.
Great to be here, you guys.
Yeah, thanks for coming on. I guess we got to give some of the listeners some context. So we've known each other for a long time, me, you, and Ryan. I started working at The Hustle in 2020. Ryan, when did you start there?
I think towards the end of 2018. So, yeah.
And Brad, when did you start at The Hustle, and what was your role at The Hustle, and then how has that evolved over time?
So I started in early 2019. So I've been there about 5 years now. And I started as the head of content at just The Hustle when it was just a newsletter. And a couple years on, we were sold to HubSpot. And then I came over in that acquisition. And now I head up not just The Hustle and the newsletter network, but also we have a blog network and a podcast network and a YouTube network. And I oversee all of those from the editorial side.
So you're like the director of content or editorial director of all that content for not just newsletter and blog, all that different stuff. And also that's doing a lot of media stuff, which I want to get into later and the strategy behind that, which is really cool. And then one thing I wanted to call out before we get into all that stuff is you have a new newsletter now that you started writing a couple weeks ago that I think is really interesting. I've been reading every issue and sharing it with friends. Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, I was especially proud that that's one of the six newsletters you actually have a subscription to your personal email, Matt. So I was honored to be one of those few. It's called Newsletter Examples, and it is kind of what it sounds like, which is just breakdowns of sort of leading newsletters, what they do right from a strategy standpoint, from templates and formats, and just the look and feel of them, as well as the content and growth side things that people are doing that are effective. And so figured there's a whole huge industry. This show's obviously about newsletter growth. There's lots of people out there who are interested in making better, more effective newsletters. And I figured what better way than to let people see what the best newsletters are doing as examples.
Yeah, I love the concept. And there's like, despite there being so many newsletters in the world and so much email content, whether it's marketing or editorial, there's not a lot of resources on how to create good editorial email newsletters. And this has been one of the few that I even know of.
Oh, thanks. Well, yeah, I mean, it's fun because that's sort of my area of expertise and interest. I'm doing this already. I was, you know, kind of sending examples of things to my team all the time. And I just got the idea, like, I'm always looking for more creative things to do. And I was interested in helping people. So put those two things together and came up with this idea. And I think you're right. You know, you've niched down into a really important area, but like I went a little bit deeper into one part of it, just like you two go pretty deep into the growth and monetization side. So we make a good team, the three of us.
Yeah, it's so in depth and so tactical. Like, it's funny because like, I mean, it's newsletter examples, but I think it's like one of the best examples of an actionable newsletter. We're getting a little meta here, but yeah, do highly recommend that everybody listening check that out.
So we want to talk about some of that stuff, some of those examples. I think that'd be a good place to start is like the in the weeds questions me and Ryan had about how to create great newsletter content. And like, you're an expert in a lot of different content things, not just newsletters, but we'll probably focus on that for this conversation. So that would be like part one. And then part two, I want to talk more about media strategy, content to commerce, what HubSpot and The Hustle have been doing, what you're doing there. I think that's just a really interesting topic in general. So like maybe second half of the podcast, we'll get into all of that. But what would be good to start with, Ryan? Like, what are the fundamentals and questions that we have that we should cover?
Well, I mean, I think really, I mean, a lot of your work in newsletter examples is, and your work just in general at The Hustle, obviously leading a huge team of writers, is identifying good writing and directing that. I guess one thing that I think a lot of listeners might be interested in, and we can kind of like, so we can start here, we can start somewhere else, but maybe, you know, when you're looking for writers for your team, how do you identify good writing, I guess, specifically in the context of a newsletter? And then I guess that also carries over to how you identify newsletters to cover and newsletter examples.
Yeah. So this question is something people ask a lot about because it's very hard to find talent out there. A lot of times you start a newsletter in a space that's very specific or niche, and you don't necessarily have the energy to write every issue yourself. And after a little honeymoon period, you realize writing a newsletter, even if it's just once a week, is pretty hard. But it's also hard to find people who can do the thing you need, because you have a specialty in that area and you understand that area. They may be better writers, but they aren't maybe as passionate about the topic area or as good in that topic area. So it's very hard. And I'll use The Hustle as an example when I think about recruiting talent. One thing that I do is I'm sort of recruiting people all the time. I don't wait until I have a job opening before I start sort of thinking about who I need to fill that job. So I think, just as a little context, back when I was a reporter, I was covering college sports for a long time. And I got this sort of dream opportunity to interview with ESPN's investigative reporting unit, and flew me up to Connecticut. I got to meet with all their top people. And when I got there, the guy in charge of this team told me, this is actually not a job interview. This is just how we do it around here. We sort of constantly survey talent. We bring people in, we vet them for when we actually do get job openings. And then, you know, we'll be ready to pull the trigger when we actually get the job. So long story short, I never ended up working there, but I did learn a lot from that process that I've incorporated into my team. And that is, I may not get to fly people in for interviews for jobs that aren't actually jobs, but I do keep kind of like this dream hire file of people I have my eye on. And so I, you know, that think that they might be a good fit at some point. And some of those people I've been talking to for years in sort of low key recruiting ways. And so once or twice a year, I'll check in with them, get to know what they're looking for so I can find the right fit for them if we might have it. Sam had this other way of recruiting people that I also loved. He used to basically like reach out to someone who he was interested in hiring, tell them about the job, hopefully get them really excited about it, and then ask them who he should recruit for the job and sort of, you know, who they thought we should be looking at. And it had sort of the same effect, which was, you know, get somebody thinking about the job, what you need, you know, hopefully get them excited about it themselves, and then essentially using your ability to attract them to do that. But those are a couple of things I think about a lot. The qualities I look for in people tend to be around like adaptability and resilience. And I look for people who've had jobs, who were hired to maybe do one thing, but they had to adapt to something else. And maybe they did really well with that and they kind of liked it. That's one reason I often don't necessarily look for traditional journalists when I hire people. And traditional journalism teaches you a lot of really positive things, like how to be fair and accurate, hit deadlines, gather information. But a lot of that you can teach people. I've sort of put more emphasis on finding someone with the right mindset, with the right attitude. And if they're passionate about the space that they're writing about, they can learn the field. Another thing I look for is people who have a strong writing voice and personality. Much of what you read in traditional journalism is kind of devoid of that. And so what I look for, it's also kind of hard to find because that kind of voice isn't just sort of naturally out in a lot of what people write professionally. So I just look at what people put on Twitter, what people put on social media, and I get a sense of their unfiltered, unedited work. And then I sort of also try to look at their ambition and what they're building for themselves, and whether that's just a newsletter or a podcast or some side project they're doing. Most journalists, they will often kind of like freelance for other publications. You get sort of, that's how you move up the ladder. You get kind of published in bigger and bigger places. But I'm more interested in seeing someone who's doing stuff on their own, not just, you know, trying to reach the pinnacle of something that's traditional journalism wants for them, but more something that someone's building that's more of a one-to-one direct relationship with an owned audience, because you're learning so much more about what it takes to reach people and kind of meet their needs. And when you have that kind of skin in the game.
That's interesting. What does the top of funnel look like for that? So I imagine, because you're doing this so long, it kind of just becomes part of your everyday life as you're scrolling through social media, it's in the back of your mind. But like, how have you discovered some of these people originally? Or even if you can share an example of someone that you've kind of found through this process and later hired, that would be cool.
Yeah. So one person, Sam has done a really good job of this over the years. Like, he sort of picked up on some tweets that Steph Smith put out maybe a year or two before we actually hired her. And so her name came across my desk as someone who was interesting, and I started following her. And then we started talking to her, and she didn't really have a traditional background in writing, but she did oversee a content team, and she had taught herself a lot of things, like sort of taught herself to code. She was very interested in just doing creative work. And so we wanted to find a position for her where, unlike her current job at the time, she was a manager of a bunch of people, we could kind of position her in a place where she could just do very independent work. So I think it was a question of like Sam noticing her, me figuring out what she wanted and needed to sort of thrive and maybe make that jump to come work for us. Because honestly, back in that day, we weren't paying people very much. I mean, we used to hire people. I won't say what specifically Steph made. She didn't make this little, but, you know, we used to pay people like $50,000, $60,000 to be writers. And we, you know, in the early years at The Hustle, we only had like one or two writers on The Hustle daily, which that is a grind. I mean, you're writing 1,500, sometimes 2,000 words every single day. You're kind of like constantly combing the internet. That is a hard, hard job. So you have to find people who have shown an ability to kind of produce content, produce quickly. You know, I look for people who sort of jump in on conversations, who are not just trying to put things out there on Twitter or whatever that are sort of self-serving, but more that they are additive to the conversation, that they have interesting things to say, that they have a point of view. And so those are the kinds of people that I'm typically looking at.
Yeah. And I think this might be an interesting point to kind of dive in a little bit more depth on, because there are a lot of folks that are listening, and, you know, ourselves included, who do weekly newsletters, but The Hustle is a daily newsletter. So there's just a constant production of content. What does the workflow look like? Like, what does the team makeup for a daily newsletter look like? And how did you learn to do that effectively?
So when I came, I think one of the goals Sam had when he hired me was, and I'm talking about Sam Parr, who started The Hustle. One of the goals Sam had was, let's try to professionalize this operation to some extent on the writing side. We had a couple of writers. At one point, I think we hired a hot dog vendor to come write the email off the streets in San Francisco. We were paying people very little, like I said. I mean, don't get me wrong, these were super talented people, but we had no bench. And when someone goes down, you're pretty screwed. So essentially, the way the email works is, like, back in that day, the writers would wake up in the morning and they would kind of comb the internet. They would figure out what were interesting stories. And then, you know, after a few hours of looking around, they would talk about those stories they were going to write for the day. And then they'd start writing. And that didn't happen until like 11 in the morning, typically. And that was like 11 in the morning, West Coast time. So it was like, you know, 2 o'clock East Coast time. So the email, you know, they had to write several stories every day, and the email wouldn't get put to bed sometimes until like 10 o'clock at night. And then they'd wake up and do the same thing every day. So one of the things I thought about was, A, can we hire more people? Can we use some freelancers? It did take us a while before we were able to kind of deepen the bench. But once we were able to, now the way we do it and the way we think about it is, we're constantly sourcing and writing stories. And we have more evergreen sections that allow us to pre-write parts of the email. So we're not always just waking up every morning and facing a blank slate. So I do think that you can get in trouble if you have single points of failure. And when in the early days, we certainly had that.
I think you called it a lot of these. What are some of the green flags when you're finding people to hire? Unique point of view, voice, any other ones that come to mind? And then could we specify, like, what a unique point of view is and why that's important? So the way you explained earlier, the way I thought about it was maybe like someone who's like a threat boy on Twitter, just promoting themselves constantly. That might not be a great fit, but someone who's replying to a lot of interesting things and sharing a cool perspective and some insights might be a better fit. Is that somewhat accurate? But tell us more.
You know, I do think it's helpful, even if you're looking for someone to mostly curate content, which is what we do in The Hustle from Monday through Friday. We have a longer form originally produced Sunday story that we do every week as well, which is a different team. But I do think it's helpful to have people who understand how to do at least a basic level of research and who have really diverse interests. So I don't really want people who come in and just like read from the same 5 or 6, you know, newsletters everyone reads every morning. So one thing we do is we give people like a timed writing test. So we ask, like, once we get to a certain stage with the candidate, we ask them, hey, give us, you know, we test them over a 2-hour period, and we give them a series of things we ask them to do. One of those things is, hey, just write this story like it was going to appear in the email tomorrow for The Hustle. So we would hopefully see in them someone who has studied us, knows what kinds of stories we look for, how deeply we need to sort of point to a variety of sources within a story, how a story needs to have multi-layers. So I look for people who can research and who, so I don't think people who do threads on Twitter are bad examples. I actually think they're pretty good examples, because that's just a story in miniature. And it shows that people can put together like a narrative arc for a story, borrowing the most interesting elements. And that's essentially what we do with the Hustle Daily.
One kind of question on that is, if you think about some of your favorite writers of The Hustle that you've worked with, maybe like a Trung or Zachary Crockett or probably a ton more, what are some of your favorite things about those people or any common traits or patterns between them that would be helpful for us to know as people who are, you know, looking to hire our first writers or build a team for the very first time?
So I guess it depends on the topic area you're covering. Like, let's say if you're Ryan and you're building out, you know, B2B newsletters for companies, that's very different than like someone who wants to start a newsletter like The Hustle, which is a little bit, you know, it's certainly a broader interest publication, even though it's more, you know, specifically about business and tech. So I think I would start with thinking about your audience and thinking about the kinds of people who have reached your audience or who, you know how to reach audiences and the way that you're trying to reach an audience, whether that's B2B or B2C. You know, some of the qualities that people have that we've had on our team, they're varied. I mean, I do think one of the most important things is like, are people smart enough to kind of know where to go find interesting things on the internet? Can they look in places where other people aren't looking and surface interesting gems and nuggets and ideas? And I think that applies almost across any type of newsletter you're doing, whether it's B2B, B2C, or whatever, because you don't want to be the same as everyone else. You know, no matter what you're covering, you want to be able to differentiate yourself. And I think there are little things that you can do in newsletters that are similar across any type of newsletter that, you know, require people to have that type of skill set and that type of curiosity. So I look for people with curiosity about the thing that you're covering or an ability to have curiosity about something that you think is translatable. I look for people who can write fast. I mean, Trung used to write stories in like 30 minutes that most reporters that I knew previously took hours to put to bed. And it was remarkable to see how good they were in that short of a time. So I think, you know, how do people have practice writing short form and writing in the style that you need in newsletters, which is very different than like a research paper in college or something that you might write in an email to someone. You know, I think someone who can, you know, somebody who stood out to me in the early days was like, there was a guy who we hired. His name was Jacob Cohen. And at the time he was a college student and he just sent me this pitch for hiring him. And he had been reading us for a while and he liked us. And so the pitch was basically in the form of the Hustle Daily email. And it was an ingenious way to get my attention because lots of people send us pitches and tell us, you know, hey, I can write for you. Come hire me. It showed me that he understood our form. It showed me that he had that personality and that sort of style that we were looking for. It was funny. It wasn't like he made a lot of jokes that were perfectly, you know, pulled off, but it showed me that he had the sort of kind of courage to take risk. And I liked that a lot too, because that's one thing that's very hard with people is like, you know, you got to do this in some cases, like with our team every single day. Some days you don't have it. You wake up and you just, you know, you got to bring it the next day. So you look for people who are regularly posting things, who aren't afraid to kind of put themselves out there. And so that was something that I thought was beneficial for us too.
I guess just to put a little bow on the end of this conversation, about like hiring writers, if there are folks, and you gave me some great advice, Brad, I remember you and I had a conversation when I was first starting Tailwind. And I think maybe it would be super valuable to folks listening as well, which is if there's somebody in the audience, they've been writing a weekly newsletter and they're experiencing what I think a lot of newsletter operators experience, which is just a little bit of fatigue about writing. They're looking to outsource part of it. What is like a five-step or just like a quick multi-step process that they can follow to find a writer, test them, and, you know, maybe negotiate some sort of a rate? Like how can somebody hire or outsource for the first time?
I think it just, again, I would start with the area that you're covering and think about, do you see people on Twitter? Do you see people, do you know people in your network who have a kind of topic area interest or expertise? And I would talk to them first and ask them about the possibilities of other people that they see. So I would start by kind of fanning out broadly to kind of widen your network of people you reach out to. And don't try to do all this on your own. I mean, LinkedIn is this terrific resource for being able to source writers, but it only tells you mostly like where people are and not actually how they perform. And so you have to kind of go two or three levels deeper to really understand if they would be a fit. So a lot of times the easiest way is to just work your network and like have people that you can help other people with as well. So you don't want to just be someone who takes from others. So when you're sourcing any information for someone, I always try to think of like, what can I do for them as well? So build that network and make sure that you're always able to help them as well, so that you're not just kind of always going to them with your hat in hand looking for help. But oftentimes within your own network or within a field of interest that you're going to be sort of writing about, there are people who are like leading voices. And if they're not the ones, then you can kind of at least talk to them about people that they know. Another thing that I do is I do use LinkedIn Recruiter Lite. And I do think that, you know, it's like, it depends on how well you can, you know, give prompts to the system, but you can turn up interesting candidates that way. And, you know, obviously there are some leading indicators of whether people are looking for work on LinkedIn, and you can kind of get a quick lead on that. You can also see if people have had experience in, you know, newsletter writing or in writing about the specific topic area that you're interested in by sort of, you know, sort of filtering for that. And then you can also see if people have been laid off. There's just been so many layoffs in journalism. And I think there are just tremendous number of people out there right now who don't actually have not traditionally made a lot of money, because traditionally journalists haven't been paid all that well, and who are actually really, really talented at once sort of given a topic area, learning about it and immersing themselves in it. Because in journalism, we call those your beats, and your beat can change. And it's actually pretty typical. Like at the New York Times, you could, you know, have five totally different jobs over, you know, 15-year career there. Your job changes a lot, your field of interest changes. And so I think people are very adaptable typically as journalists. And I think you can source folks that way, because, you know, I think journalists are also really good at sticking to deadlines. That's something you need in that world. And they're usually good writers. And so, I mean, you kind of checked off like maybe three out of the five boxes you're looking to fill. And, you know, maybe you don't always need somebody who has a lot of personality and voice in their writing. And maybe that can evolve over time as they start writing the newsletter and they can become a little more conversant in writing in a style that's more newsletter-like.
I don't know if you can answer this question or if you have an answer, but are there any pools of people or organizations you've pulled people from? Like, I found this in my career, and I think there's been other people who have found the same, where it's like, you know, there's a lot of, I'm a marketing agency for media companies. There's a lot of great e-commerce marketing agencies. I can think of like three or four who are the best in the world. I pull a lot of people from those companies and recruit them over. Anything like that, that's been a parallel for you and your work?
No, but I think I need to build it, honestly. You know, Ryan, you and I talked about this at one point, and I just feel like, I know there are people out there who have agencies and who place people, but there is a huge need for not just people who write newsletters and want to build their own newsletter, but people who are doing like what you're doing with Tailwind, Ryan, and want to build companies around this. And I think they need to source talented writers who are dependable. So I certainly think there's an opening in a, it's something that I've been thinking about as well.
I think that would make the process of finding writers a lot simpler if they were Brad Wolverton vetted. But you just had somebody who, yeah, that would make everything a lot easier. Can't confirm.
Yeah, thanks. Cool. And that seems to be a service that's popping up, not for writing, but like for other types of roles, especially like near outsourcing or near sourcing talent. And maybe there's a combination of that you could do, which would be super cool. This is like, I think Sam Parr is really good at this, but any thoughts on like when you don't have a big budget, how do you get people to come on board, you know, buy into your mission and want to work at your company? Is there anything The Hustle did well? Because I think they did, you know, brought on a lot of talented entrepreneurial people for not a lot of money, including myself, you know? But like, how does that work?
Well, as you pointed out, it really helps to have a magnetic personality who can draw people like Sam, and people want to be attached to that. I mean, you had people like Steph and Trung who were already sort of on the rise in their own ways. And I think that they recognized that being in Sam's orbit would only help them, even if they didn't work there forever. And so, and that certainly was the case. I mean, I think Sam has helped a lot of people grow and kind of like elevate their own status in terms of like social media and so forth. But I think for me, it was that's the start of it. But I think more importantly is, how do you keep people somewhere? Like you mentioned this guy, Zach Crockett, before, and Zach was probably maybe the most talented person I've ever worked with. He was at The Hustle, and before that he worked at like Vox Media, and he's done a bunch of stuff for NPR, and he was like a super talented podcaster, and now he has his own show at Freakonomics called The Economics of Everyday Things. Anyway, Zach was the guy who wrote those Sunday long form stories. So every week he would research this long piece and just did such a terrific job. But one of the reasons why we kept Zach so long was because I helped clear the path for Zach. So I kept distractions away from him. So I took care of all of those things that would normally sort of get in the way of someone as a writer. And that was one of the things we promised Trung, and one of the things we promised Steph was like, that's what I do as much as possible, is clear a path for you and also work with you personally and give you a lot of time to help, you know, help improve your work, help make sure that, you know, you're like giving and doing the kinds of things that you want to be doing and not being told, like in most workplaces, what to go do.
Can you explain like clear a path? Because one thing I noticed was like the editorial team, the company team is not on like all of the meetings that we do as a company because they're like busy doing things. So just collaborate a little bit more on like how you do that for people.
Yeah. So I pretty much take those calls and I'm in those meetings because it's important to have representatives from the editorial side in lots of calls. But for the most part, I keep the team away from that. And I pretty much just give them the chance to kind of put their heads down and do creative work. That's what most creators want. They don't want to have to sit in meetings and they don't want that bureaucracy. And so as much as possible, if you can clear that, you know, clear the brush from them, get rid of the obstacles instead of putting obstacles in front of them, then I think they'll be happier and they'll stick around longer term.
Ryan and Brad, what else should we cover about content newsletters before we get to like the content to commerce conversation, the strategy stuff?
I was going to say, I think it seems like a good point to top into kind of HubSpot thesis, content to commerce. So Matt, I'll let you, I know you had a question to open that.
Before we get into that, I actually have one question around like, a lot of people ask about like newsletter. There's no perfect answer to this, but newsletter templates, newsletter formats. You're covering examples in your newsletter examples, so people can look at that to see examples of that. But sorry, I don't have a specific question here, but like, how do you think about that? If someone is let's say it's a company, could be a SaaS company, any type of business that wants to start a newsletter, or someone who is, you know, wants to start a newsletter business or a media company, how should they think about what the format of their newsletter is and what's inside of it? Not necessarily like how the content is written, but just like the blocks of it, the basic building blocks here.
I think you should look to, and I realize this may sound self-serving, but I think you should look to the best newsletters that do this and are the most effective. I'll give you just one example, a newsletter called 1440, which has grown super fast in the last few years. I think they started in 2017. They have like 3.5 million subscribers now. They are about as stripped down as you can be in terms of like the kind of template and format that they present to the world every day. But, you know, they start with sort of like a section that's like what you need to know, like essential things. And I think you should put yourself in the mind of the subscriber. We've had subscribers get onto Zoom calls with us and like open up the email and show us how they read it. Typically what I find is like the shorter, the better, the less sort of throat clearing at the top of the email, the better. Meaning like, what are you sort of waiting around? What do you feel like you need to beat around the bush? Just get to the thing people are coming to you for as soon as possible. Keep it as streamlined, as simple as possible, and, you know, get in and out of it. Allow people to kind of not feel like you don't have to put everything in the email every day. And I think that sometimes the simpler format is better. And because people like, you know, my friend Kendall Baker, who writes Yahoo Sports AM, who used to write Axios Sports, talks about the fact that people love to finish things. And, you know, if you're good and you're really useful to them and they can finish this every day without sort of like feeling like they can't get through it, they're going to come back tomorrow. So I think there's this delicate balancing act of like making sure you give people enough information that's useful to them, but not too much that they won't want to come back tomorrow for more.
That's a good line. Any thoughts on like how long via reading time or word count a newsletter should be, or how many sections a newsletter should be?
Honestly, one other thing I would say before I answer that is I look for elements that are repeatable, but also habit forming. So what are things that, like, whether you have 3 sections or 5, what are things that people are going to naturally want to come back for every day? What makes them come back and open that email? I mean, just to use Kendall as an example, he has this a trivia question at the bottom of every email. It's become one of the reasons why people open his email, why they've shared it with lots of other people, because they basically do like sports trivia games every day. And like whoever gets the answer, like, I mean, it's just sort of a contest for people. And it's like the email itself may be kind of like decide the point. They open it to get that question, which you don't necessarily want. You want people to read the whole thing, but give them stuff that makes them come back. And that's the thing that I think is most important. And so to answer your question about how many sections, how long should an email be? Again, I put a bias on like shorter is better, and do sections that are differentiated and that make you stand out and that make people come back for the next read.
I don't want to get into this too much, but like one final question on that is, any other good examples of habit building things in email? Another like fundamental one is like Morning Brew has the tickers at the top of their newsletter where it's like S&P 500, you know, oil. Some people might just check kind of the market prices via Morning Brew every day. What else have you seen out there?
Well, I'll play off what you and Ryan talked about the other day, which is like memes. People love memes. Why don't more people do memes in their emails? Why don't people do jokes more? You know, like back, if you think of newspapers, which were like one of the original forms of what people would read on a daily basis, they had a comic section. They had sports sections. They had things that I think were, you know, sometimes people considered those like the toy department. Like they were sort of like not as serious, but they were the things that like really mattered. And so I think, you know, if you have jobs that you can list that people can come back for and maybe they find jobs. I mean, there's a newsletter I used to read when I covered college sports. It was called the D1 Ticker for Division I. This thing is literally like, it's endless, but it's just like every job in college sports that's out there, and people will read them and scroll through them. And it's really useful for that audience. So it just depends. I mean, we're trying to do this of a series of things too. We have a section that we call Around the Web in the Hustle Now. And it's our most clicked section. It is, you know, it has a video of like some animal at the bottom. It has this date in history. It has, you know, very simple productivity kinds of hacks and things like that that are just really useful for people. So those are things that I think really resonate. But you could do weather. You could do, you know, all kinds of things like, again, this day in history. Things that are just like relevant for your industry. Just seriously, just brainstorm, just look at examples of what other people use and kind of have the mindset of like, what are habit forming things for those people? And how can I do things like that?
Yeah, I remember like the meme of the day, which Lasso also uses a lot, I think. I always enjoyed that. The shower thoughts from Lasso, which were kind of like, I think just kind of like curating stuff from a couple subreddits.
How could I miss the shower thoughts? I can't believe I forgot that. Literally, we used to have one time we forgot to run shower thoughts. These come out every Friday. And like our open rates on Friday have historically always been better. We got so much hate mail the day we forgot to put the shower thoughts in. And you could just have like a whole email that's just shower thoughts. You could have a whole email that's just around the web of just these cool things that I mentioned a minute ago. Like I think of, if you're going to build sections, think of sections, keep them short, but think of them as almost like there are emails within emails that are so good. People will want to open your entire email just to read that part.
Yeah, I feel like I need to go look at some great historical magazines and newspapers and just, I haven't done that in years. You get a sense of like all the different formats and stuff in there, and like, you know, readers writing into the magazine and the editor responding. There's like so many different cool things that we can get creative about.
I mean, one other thing to think about is if you look at the way magazines work, I mean, there when you kind of break down the sections of magazines, they have this section called FOB, which is front of book. They call magazines like books in New York. And so the front of the book section is like where you have these like little appetizers and like where you're whetting people's appetite with sort of short little interesting stories or little nuggets or like call outs, like a number or some factoid or something like that. And then the middle section is called the feature well, where you have like the deeper, more long reported, originally reported things that are kind of like contrarian or like make people think deeply about something. And then at the end, you have like sort of the fun stuff, like a back page, which may be just a cartoon or something that's like somebody's point of view on some topic that's controversial. So if you just sort of took those elements and thought of how could you build a newsletter using some of those things, you could probably learn a lot too.
It's very smart.
Yeah, such a great framework. I don't think there are a lot of operators thinking of it in terms of building habit-forming sections. You know, it's just kind of like, oh, like, is this content valuable? But maybe even just using that framework, you could see people, your open rate or your engagement go up quite a bit.
Totally. I mean, you know, one other that comes to mind is like, you don't have to just look at print type things or text-based things. You can look at like what works on YouTube or what works on TikTok or like what are people doing that's really interesting, like even more traditional television, like, you know, I don't know, just like clips, cool video clips, basically are stuff people go on all those other platforms for. So why can't you package those differently and put them in a newsletter?
Yeah. I mean, when you said habit forming, the first thing that popped into my mind is like Wordle or like connections like those, the New York Times games, I'm sure there's a reason why they bought them, right? It's because they want to drive people to their media ultimately. And so, yeah, it's like, how can you gamify opening an email? I love the example of the trivia question. So maybe something interesting, I mean, even for like a future, just like a future podcast or something, it's like thinking through how can you gamify an email? And who knows, maybe there'll be technology or integrations where you can do that more easily in the future. But
yeah, I mean, Beehive's poll feature makes it a little bit easier. Like The Hustle was the first one I saw that did polls, but it was just with like Google Forms. So I think we'll see more of that. But cool, let's shift to like part two of this, which is the content to commerce stuff. I don't have a ton of different questions on this. I just really wanted to start a discussion with you, Brad, about there have been these acquisitions like HubSpot bought The Hustle in 2020, I think. Recently, Robinhood bought Charter, and before that, they bought the Snacks newsletter. There's probably at least half a dozen more that are out there where it's like kind of like SaaS companies or software companies or tech companies buying a media company. And there's lots of reasons why. Maybe you can tell us some of those. Like the obvious ones are customer acquisition, lowering CAC. But just give us like your overall thoughts on why that's happening, what you think about, and then we'll get into it.
Yeah, for sure. So HubSpot was interested in The Hustle in part. I mean, they had always been like, they had this really strong inbound marketing engine. So people, like, they put out blog posts and they got lots of leads and signups for their software business through those blog posts, like people who had high intent on topic areas that they would cover on the blog. And then they would land on the site and then they would click on something and download it. And then they would be sort of in the marketing funnel. But what HubSpot was not able to do before they brought on The Hustle was, I think, hire a sort of more sophisticated level of talent that had done more kind of mainstream news and mainstream media. And so I think one of the goals that HubSpot had was to just like deepen their bench really fast and hire a team of people that had been successful in the sort of, I don't know, the B to C market. So it was like a big newsletter that was very popular with a lot of consumers. So we had over 1 million consumers when they acquired us. And they thought of us obviously as like, we came in and we became owned media for them. So instead of just like taking out a bunch of ads and newsletters, they acquired our newsletter and now they own all the ad inventory. So one of the things that happened early on in that when we were first acquired was, you know, HubSpot had produced hundreds of offers. These are just basically things that you would download, like a template or, you know, social media trends or something like that. And you'd see it on a blog post and then you would download it. So we just decided to put those offers in The Hustle email in place of where we would normally put ads. And we just assumed that that would, you know, draw people and attract them. And what we found was that it wasn't as the audience wasn't as interested in necessarily those same things that those people came to the blog to with high intent to kind of maybe potentially try out the software. So what we pivoted into is we started doing more offers that were around productivity and things that, you know, help people do their jobs and templates and tools that were more useful to them. And as a result, we've had a lot more people take interest in those offers and a lot more people sort of thereby, you know, become kind of put themselves into the broader marketing funnel that can eventually maybe make them a HubSpot consumer of software.
Yeah, I mean, we should specify that's kind of how HubSpot's marketing funnel works is they get a lead through these lead magnets. There's hundreds of them. They go into marketing automations and based off of many different things, you know, the massive sales team from HubSpot will reach out to some of those people and eventually they'll become a customer through a funnel kind of like that. I'm sure there's other funnels too, but that's a really big one for them. And traditionally that was through SEO traffic from the blog and then these kind of lead magnets within the blog. One thing we should mention is the HubSpot blog was huge and is huge. I think when, I don't know if this is still accurate, but when we joined there, like the blog was getting more traffic than TechCrunch. You know, it's like their website gets more traffic than a lot of large media companies.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, we're bigger than Harvard Business Review, HBR, TechCrunch. You know, HubSpot itself generally is like a top 100 website. I mean, it's a powerful growth engine for the company. But the, you know, the blog itself gets 10 to 15 million uniques a month. And it's, you know, obviously facing a lot of challenges in Google search, like a lot of businesses, but it's held its own because the content is really high quality. It's, you know, I think we've stepped up the quality of content over the years. And, you know, I think that is just like one of the ways that we drive leads for the business. So another thing we did upon the, you know, after the acquisition was we took The Hustle and we turned it into a podcast that now gets downloaded millions of times a month. And we turned it into a YouTube channel that has grown really rapidly. And we obviously grew well beyond just the Hustle name. So we developed a podcast network, and now it has about 30 shows. We have 6 owned shows. We have My First Million is still one of the shows that HubSpot owns. Huge show, one of the best shows on the internet in terms of, like, last year won a Webby Award. So we also have, you know, more owned shows in the YouTube space, and we're growing really fast in that direction. So there's a lot of different things that the team has been able to do that have, you know, I think been accelerated because of the acquisition of The Hustle.
Tell me about, like, what you mentioned some of these. What are some of the things that HubSpot wanted to do strategy-wise when they acquired The Hustle? So one was just building the team of, like, a really strong team of journalists, editorial, whereas the team before were basically content marketers. They were writing SEO-focused content. So it's, like, totally different type of content. Obviously, acquire an audience. But outside of that, what are the type of things that they wanted to do strategy-wise? One you kind of alluded to is, like, multimedia. I don't think they had podcasts before The Hustle. I don't think they had much of a... They had a YouTube channel, but not much of a YouTube presence. Tell us, like, can you list out some of the different things that were key priorities for HubSpot?
Yeah, I mean, you've named some of them. If you look back to the deck, which I've since seen of, like, how they thought about what they were acquiring and what they wanted to acquire, a big part of it was this was a talent acquisition. So I don't think it was as easy for them, you know, being a software company that sells CRM software, to just go out and find people who would want to come and work for them and do the type of media that The Hustle does. And they recognized that, you know, they were really, you know, pretty smart years in advance of knowing that, like, Google wasn't the sort of, you know, the only thing you want to hitch your ride to. You want to basically be able to do really actual, like, media like The Hustle was doing, and not as much just content marketing. I still think content marketing remains, like, at the core of what is important for HubSpot. And I think it will continue to be. It's still by far the biggest lead generator for the business. But, you know, in terms of, like, if we have multiple goals, we have goals that we're sort of the KPIs we have, we're goaled on, like, the size of our audience and the type of reach and influence that we have, and the types of products that we were able to bring to HubSpot allowed us to grow the reach and influence much bigger. And then we also grew a creator network. So that was another huge play for us. So having a number of really talented creators that they were able to acquire in the acquisition kind of allowed us to sort of also market ourselves as a place for top creators. And then we built this huge creator network around that. And I think we have the vast majority of our podcasts and YouTube shows are, you know, licensing deals with creators. And so they basically, they're in the HubSpot podcast network or whatever. And then they're in this sort of, there's this kind of flywheel effect where they get to grow a lot faster. And that, you know, as a result, our influence and reach grows a lot. And so we just kind of get to reach a lot more people who may ultimately be one day interested in HubSpot software.
You mentioned that changing the offer in the newsletter to being more like productivity stuff that maybe Hustle readers would be more interested in. That was one of the lessons that you guys learned in driving conversions to those lead magnets. Anything else, like, tactically that, like, driving newsletter subscribers to a conversion offer that you tested and found was, like, a big win? Any lessons for folks that are listening?
Yeah, one thing that we've found is, you know, you always think, well, back when you're an independent media company like The Hustle was originally, and your job is to kind of, like, grow your revenue as best you can. I mean, there's different ways you can do that. You can have events, you can do other things that are, you know, you could have a paid subscription offering like we started, you can do reports, all kinds of other things. But by and large, your goal is to get that audience to be as big as possible and to be as engaged as possible, and then to sell slots, advertising slots in front of that. And here, you know, there's a point at which your size doesn't matter as much. You still have a lot of influence when you have a couple million subscribers. Does it help you to have 3 or 4? I guess so. But it also, you can use that as a point of leverage in cross promotions with other newsletters. So instead of just only relying on the offers that we can generate from our own audience in The Hustle, we now, instead of necessarily always going to people who we, you know, do cross promotions with and trade outs, or where we buy in, you know, ads for other publications, we will use the Hustle as a point of leverage and just basically give them space in The Hustle. And in exchange, we will put, instead of just, you know, something that tries to get people to sign up for The Hustle in their newsletter, we will put an actual offer that will drive them to, you know, become more of, get them to be a lead quicker for HubSpot. And in certain areas, that works really well. Like our company is very big in AI and development of AI technology. And so I think that's been very, you know, very, very helpful for us is like we've gotten the big audience and that's a place everyone, like a lot of newsletters want to be in front of that audience because they can grow their newsletter if like, say they're an AI newsletter and we can get in front of a large audience of AI experts and put an offer in front of them quicker than, you know, by trying to get them to become a Hustle subscriber first and then putting an offer in front of them about something that they may not be as specifically interested in.
That's so interesting. I don't know of many folks that are thinking of it this way, many newsletter operators that are thinking of it this way, but you have this huge audience and now you're able to leverage that to place the product or service offer in somebody else's newsletter. You're using the newsletter as kind of the trade in that. That's so interesting.
Brad, what do you think about some of these plays that there's not been a ton out there, but there's probably also a ton that I don't know super well, but like Charter was acquired by Robinhood in December of last year to be a part of Sherwood Media, you know, about the Snacks to Robinhood one, which happened in 2019. Another one's kind of similar, or not similar, but another one that's like a marketing software. Backlinko is like a blog, was acquired by SEM Rush. Carrier Media acquired by MailChimp. I don't know as much about that one. Why do you think these are happening? And if you have any reactions or thoughts on any of those particular acquisitions, I'd love to hear about it.
I mean, I feel like they're happening in part because they see trailblazers like HubSpot that have had success with acquisitions like this. And they feel like, you know, if they bring them in, they can grow them faster, or maybe those products can help their businesses grow faster. So I think it's a shortcut to trying to kind of establish authority and expertise in an area. And they often, I'm not saying every time, but they often don't work. The products end up changing. They're not as effective as products. Like the team of people who are like writing or building those products may not stay very long. So it's very hard to like, you really need to make sure if you're going to do that, that the people you're acquiring or the products you're acquiring, you know how they can like help you and be monetized most effectively for you. And I would just be doing some tests to figure out what that looks like. Make sure that their lists aren't full of bots. Make sure that like their lists don't overlap too much with your marketing lists, do things like that. But I think also really figure out what the, like, can you find people like me, frankly, HubSpot, I think benefited by finding certain people at the Hustle who were willing to stay and willing to kind of roll up their sleeves and build these products in a new way. Sometimes if you're just hiring the creator, they're not as willing to stay. Like if you look at our team has turned over almost entirely, except for a couple of us since that acquisition, but they knew that we had these processes and that those processes allowed for us to kind of hire more people. Like I know how to hire people. I know how to develop talent. I know how to keep people around. And so look for people if you're going to acquire those kinds of those outlets who are willing to stay long time. It does help to pay them really well, but I think that you need to incentivize and figure out what incentivizes them and make sure that you can keep them, because I think you don't want to ruin what you're buying. You know, I mean, I'll say this, like one newsletter that I really liked in its previous form more is called like Patent Drop, which is this fascinating idea of like just looking at patents. And there's like a huge, there's like a, obviously AI, there's almost like gold rush mentality of these companies and they're trying to like establish patents over all kinds of different areas. And it was a really simple format before. It was like they showed you the patent, it was a quick description. And now there's just a whole lot of description of what it means and what it could mean. And maybe the people who are, you know, who own it now and like whose audience is now reading it is likes that. But I just like the simple, you know, former version of it. So I think sometimes what you change may end up coming back and hurting you.
Yeah. So like if it ain't broke, don't fix it. I definitely relate to that. There's like different ways to run these too. So there's one where it's like, do the HubSpot model where like you have all the inventory. And then Sherwood's doing something interesting where they're like an independent LLC, they're selling ads. And I'm assuming Robinhood has some of that inventory too. I don't really know exactly how it works. And they're trying to, I don't know if they're trying to be profitable independently, but they're trying to be a revenue generating business and grow independently from Robinhood, not just be a customer acquisition play for Robinhood. If you're like, if you run like a $1 billion SaaS company, you know, Brad's SaaS, and you want to acquire a media company and do this play, how would you think about integrating it into the software company that you own? Or it doesn't have to be software, but the larger acquirer. And like, what business model would you want to use? It doesn't have to be just those two examples I gave. There's probably a lot of different ways to slice this up and do it differently.
I don't know. It's a tough question. I mean, I probably just because of my own experience of what has worked and what hasn't worked, I would probably speak from that mostly. And that is, again, I think you want to make sure that when you're thinking about acquiring another organization, whether it's a newsletter or whatever, you want to make sure you understand kind of what potential it has and how that fits in with what you're trying to do and how you're trying to grow. And so it may mean that like you might see sort of a growth trajectory somewhere, and you might think that because it's been on a path to grow at a certain pace, you know, you can continue to expect it to grow at a certain pace going forward. I think you have to be pretty conservative about growth expectations and not base it on like just what people have done in the past, because a lot of times, like, for example, right now, if you looked at AI newsletters and you see this rocket ship growth of AI newsletters, I can assure you that they're not going to grow at that same pace. And in fact, many of them have leveled off, and there's almost been like a flattening out of like the business there. So anyway, I would be really cautious, and I would be betting much more conservatively. I think some of the multiples that newsletters got a couple of years ago were inflated, frankly. I mean, I think if you're like acquiring the Milk Road and you have a business model where you can kind of monetize that around crypto, that's one thing. But some of the media companies, like say, take The Athletic, that was acquired for $500 million by the New York Times. What is the Athletic doing for the New York Times right now? I don't know. Is it able to like help them grow from 7 to 10 million in subscribers? Maybe they had a lot of subscribers at first, but I don't know. I think you just have to think about what your long-term play looks like and how you can kind of tweak that thing to make it align with what you need in the long term.
Yeah, there's definitely better deals out there now, because some of the multiples in 2021 were really large. Industry Dive had a large multiple. It's a great business, but a lot of these businesses, Morning Brew, I think, had a pretty big multiple. Yeah, it's cool. It's a hard question. I just kind of want to open the discussion before we wrap up, because I think it's an interesting question, idea, and I think the answer is like we got to see how it plays out in the world, and we got a couple examples to follow and more to come.
I just have one last question before we wrap up, maybe we'll include it, maybe we won't, depending on the answer. But do you have any, as a longtime kind of media guy, do you have any advice for Matt and I on our podcast and how we do things?
You know, it's so funny, because I was almost going to make the same point. Before we go, I want to say to you that I'm a regular listener of this show, and it's very good, and I like it when you get very tactical. The shows that I like best are actually not the ones in which you have guests. So maybe do fewer of those. I know you're starting to do, you know, every couple of weeks or whatever, one with just the two of you. But I think, you know, what we've learned with, we have this show called Marketing Against the Grain, and we started that, and it was a show where, just like a lot of podcasts, you bring people on who are experts, and you get the best marketers in the world, and you start talking to them. And because you are two really good marketers, you're asking smart questions, but it never feels like it gets like into the enough depth or into what I call like the marrow of things. And like, that is where, like a couple of weeks ago, you had this podcast where you're talking about, hey, what are like five new business ideas for cool newsletters I would go start? To me, that was probably my favorite podcast you've done. It was just like really actionable, great ideas. Almost every single thing you said was smart, and you played off each other really well. So sometimes it requires a little more advanced work on your part to think like, okay, well, what are we going to talk about today? And not just who are we going to have on and what kinds of questions might we ask that person, but what are you bringing to the table? What, like, and you both bring a lot to the table. And like, I think, you know, having a mix of people on here who have expertise that's maybe different than yours, or you want to bring people on who are like growing really fast that others can learn from, but don't undervalue the skill that you have in just talking about your own expertise. So I would just, and you guys have great rapport, so I would do more of that, and I would come prepared with, you know, these sort of like, hey, let's just brainstorm this. What do you think we could do?
Yeah. I'm glad you gave that advice, because I think that's what we want to do. We got to come prepared. That's the key part to that, and like keep improving. But I'm glad you said that. Another thing we want to have on like recurring guests, like you, Brad, people like we know, Ethan Brooks. And so we have that same people that we have the same type of rapport with.
Yeah. Where we can get a little bit more, to your point, like more tactical, right? And maybe talk. I mean, like we've known each other for years now, so I feel like we could just dive right in. But a lot of times, and you know, it's good to introduce people to the audience and everything, but there is that like introductory phase when you're bringing on a guest to interview. you can't really dive right into it, to the tactical, and get right into it for a 1 hour podcast. So that's great, great advice.
So everybody check out newsletterexamples.co to subscribe to Brad's newsletter. Brad, where else should people go to check you out, or how else can you help people?
Yeah, I mean, I'm trying to post a little bit more on X. I do really love, I've been kind of a lurker there for a long time, but I'm trying to follow in your all's footsteps and just, you know, be a little bit more active. I learn a lot, and I think it's just a great community. So I'm at just my name, Brad Wolverton, on X. So if you can follow me there, that'd be great too.
Yeah, cool. Thanks, Brad. We'll link all that stuff below. And thanks, everybody, for listening. Thank you for listening. I hope you're enjoying this podcast. And if you are, we are hosting a live virtual event for podcast listeners. Me and Ryan Carr are going to do a Q&A, fireside chat, and hang out with our listeners who love the podcast. To get access to that, you just need to do three simple things that will help us grow the podcast faster and reach more people. Number one is to leave a 5-star review on Apple Podcast or Spotify. Number two is to subscribe to the YouTube channel. You can find that by searching Matt McGarry on YouTube. That's where we publish the podcast video. And then number three is to send a screenshot of both of those things to me so I can send you an invite. Send that to my email, which is matt@newsletteroperator.com. That's also linked in the podcast description below. And that is it. That's all you need to do to get an invite. We will be doing this live call, or potentially multiple live calls of our listeners, after we reach 100 five-star reviews on Apple Podcast or Spotify and 1,000 YouTube subscribers. So the sooner you do that, the sooner you'll get the invite, and the sooner we'll be able to do this call with you, and it will be a lot of fun. So I hope to see you there.